available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our summer fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $50,000 by June 29th. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for news in depth.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Northwest Office Liquidations, a family-owned business in Portland for over 30 years, offering an inventory of office furniture, full-service office design and space planning, and liquidation services. More info at northwestofficeliquidations.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. The legality of Trump's tariffs is in the courts, but the costs to companies are rising fast. Next, Trump's growing impatience over the wars in Ukraine and Gaza. And while another Gaza ceasefire deal is under discussion, Palestinians are starving. First, the legality of Trump's tariffs and the costs to companies. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of International Trade has ruled that tariffs imposed under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act are illegal. Oregon and 11 other states brought the suit. The president said the court does not have the power under the 1977 Act, which pertains to trade embargoes and sanctions, not to correcting trade deficits or promoting trade negotiations. The president identified the emergency, says a Justice Department lawyer, and he decided the means to address that emergency. This lawyer added that the goal had been to bring our trading partners to the table and create political leverage for possible deal-making, to which one of the judges said, quote, "It may be a very dandy plan, but it has to meet the statute." Importantly, the suit was joined by prominent conservative and liberal lawyers and former officials. They argued that Trump's tariffs violated the commerce regulatory power that the Constitution gives to Congress. A White House spokesman denounced the trade court's ruling, saying, quote, "It is not for unelected judges to decide how to properly address a national emergency. Trump, he promised, will use every lever of executive power to address this crisis." The administration immediately appealed the ruling and was granted a temporary pause, enabling the tariffs to stay in place. Meantime, Reuters reports on the rapidly rising costs to corporations of the tariff war. Quote, "Trump's trade war has cost companies more than $34 billion in lost sales and higher costs, a toll that is expected to rise as ongoing uncertainty over tariffs paralyzes decision-making at some of the world's largest companies. Across the U.S., Asia, and Europe, companies including Apple, Ford, Porsche, and Sony have pulled or slashed their profit forecasts, and an overwhelming majority say the erratic nature of Trump's trade policies has made it impossible to accurately estimate costs. True to the criticism of being erratic, Trump suddenly doubled the rate on steel and aluminum imports to 50%. That earned him a new acronym coined by the Financial Times and repeated by the Wall Street Journal. TACO, Trump always chickens out. Perhaps his anger at that, which he displayed when a reporter asked him about it, accounts for his latest tariff hike on steel and aluminum. Other sources are reporting on growing bank and business concern over the bond market, which is a key indicator of investor confidence in the U.S. Trump's tariffs and his tax bill will greatly increase the national debt. Will foreign investors continue to buy U.S. Treasury bills to finance the debt? Or, as many banks and businesses believe, will they pull back, resulting in rising interest rates on home mortgages, auto financing, and credit cards? Next, Trump's growing impatience over the wars in Ukraine and Gaza. As I have suggested before, Trump's China strategy depends on securing an end to the fighting in Ukraine and Israel. How that happens is far less important to him than getting credit for ending them and enabling him to turn to his main goal, which is containing China. But his impatience is not being rewarded by Vladimir Putin and Benjamin Netanyahu. Following Russia's largest ever drone strike on Ukraine, Trump posted, quote, "Something has happened to him," meaning Putin. "He has gone absolutely crazy. I've always said that he wants all of Ukraine, not just a piece of it, and maybe that's proving to be right. But if he does, it will lead to the downfall of Russia," unquote. But he also criticized Ukraine's President Zelensky, posting that the Ukrainian leader, quote, "is doing his country no favors by talking the way he does. Everything out of his mouth causes problems. I don't like it, and it better stop." The Russian response suggested that Trump was being too emotional. As usual, a few days later, Trump pivoted, saying he didn't want to take any action against Russia that might upset prospects for a Russia-Ukraine agreement. He gave Russia another few weeks to act positively, but in a second round of talks with Ukraine that lasted only about an hour, the Russians made demands, not concessions. Then followed Ukraine's devastating attacks on Russian airfields the other day, and Putin's apparent plan to retaliate. Thus, when Trump insists that this isn't Trump's war, his failure to act against Russia speaks otherwise. In Israel, the Netanyahu government is being hit left and center by attacks on his war policy. Trump is adding to Netanyahu's headaches as the U.S. negotiates with Iran, with Trump saying he stopped Israel from attacking Iran. Beyond that incident is the path to peace that Netanyahu persists in blocking, according to David Ignatius of The Washington Post. He writes, quote, "What's agonizing is that Israeli military and intelligence leaders were ready to settle this conflict nearly a year ago. Working with U.S. and Emirati officials, they developed a plan for security bubbles that would contain the violence, starting in northern Gaza and moving south, backed by an international peacekeeping force that would include troops from European and moderate Arab countries. In place of Hamas, a Palestinian government backed by a reformed Palestinian Authority would take political control. But Netanyahu said no. His right-wing coalition partners demanded total victory. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, which had agreed to provide troops and money for Gaza security, got tired of waiting. While another Gaza ceasefire deal is under discussion, Palestinians are starving. President Trump's envoy to Middle East talks, Steve Witkoff, has brought a new ceasefire proposal to Israel and Hamas. According to the Times of Israel, under the proposal, Hamas would release 10 living Israeli hostages held in Gaza and return the bodies of 18 deceased hostages during a 60-day ceasefire. In return, Israel would release 125 Palestinian terror convicts serving life sentences, 1,111 Gazans detained since the start of the war on October 7, and 180 bodies of Palestinians currently held by Israel. The Israeli Defense Forces would also pull back from some areas where troops are currently deployed, unquote. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is said to have approved the deal, but Hamas's reaction is uncertain. One Hamas official said the U.S. proposal means, quote, "perpetuating the occupation and continuing the killing and famine, even during the temporary truce period." Other reports suggest Hamas will accept the proposal in principle, but contend with Israel over the details. Meanwhile, the wanton Israeli killing of civilians continues. Israel's army has killed at least 50 Palestinians who swarmed to aid distribution centers over a three-day period just recently in a desperate search for food. This New York Times report on June 3rd says it all, quote, The shootings, which the military said occurred roughly about 500 yards from the food distribution site, were the latest chaos surrounding a contentious new Israeli-backed system for food distribution sites in Gaza, where American private contractors oversee the handout of cardboard boxes of aid. The Israeli-American initiative has only announced 4 aid distribution points, compared with 400 under the previous United Nations-coordinated aid distribution system. And on most days, most of the 4 sites have not been operational, unquote. The UN warned that this tragedy was likely to happen, given near-starvation conditions in Gaza and the minimal food handouts. In other news, Vietnam buys favor with Trump. Vietnam may have won the war with the United States, but it cannot escape the U.S. power of persuasion, least of all in the Trump era. Saddled with a 46% tariff rate by Trump and pressured by his administration to stop exporting Chinese origin goods, Vietnam has found favor with Trump in the way so many other countries have: build him a golf complex and hotel. Thus, we find Eric Trump leading a ceremony that included Vietnam's prime minister to break ground on a $1.5 billion golf complex outside Hanoi, a complex that will force thousands of farmers to sell their land at a reduced price and relocate. The Times reports, quote, legal experts said the project was in conflict with the province's housing master plan. The entire complex, with Trump-designed villas and 36 holes of golf in one of 4 development zones, would add 35,000 residents, theme parks, and an urban commercial district. On top of that, the project is planned in a riverfront area that flooded during a typhoon last year, and the province is dotted with unexploded ordnance from the Vietnam War. A 200-pound bomb was discovered 6 months ago, unquote. The Vietnam government fast-tracked the deal, bypassing laws that required approval at several levels before the project could go forward. The Trump project was approved in a few months instead of years. For Trump, the most corrupt president in U.S. history, profiting while in office is commonplace. Personal business becomes foreign policy. The Trump Organization becomes the State Department. Few legal challenges, either abroad or at home, have stood in his way, whether in Serbia, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, or the United Arab Emirates. Vietnam's willingness to placate Trump rests on its high dependence on exports, especially to the U.S. The Trump administration has insisted that Vietnam stop Chinese transshipment of goods made in China but bearing the label Made in Vietnam. Chinese firms, seeking to go around U.S. tariffs on their goods, send them to Vietnam for shipment to the U.S. Distinguishing those exports from goods manufactured in Vietnam using Chinese materials is difficult, however. Trump's tariffs on China are the real source of the problem, since they forced Chinese exporters and manufacturers to relocate to Vietnam and elsewhere in Southeast Asia. Calling everything that originates in Vietnam a transshipment is decidedly unfair. The U.S.-Iran nuclear talks, 1 agreement so far. Last week, I reported that Iran has proposed to establish a 3-country nuclear consortium, including the U.S. and 2 Arab countries, in which Iran would enrich uranium to a low grade, beneath that needed for nuclear weapons, and then ship it to other Arab countries for civilian use. Then came a report that the U.S. had accepted the consortium idea, but insisted that Iran terminate all uranium enrichment. Iran has said it would never accept ending all enrichment. A report just days ago says the U.S. will now accept minimum Iranian enrichment and leave other details to a later date. This news comes as the International Atomic Energy Agency has found that Iran now has greatly expanded its enrichment program, so that it now has enough near-bomb-level enriched uranium to quickly build 10 nuclear weapons if it chooses. Rafael Grossi, Director General of the IAEA, says that, quote, the significantly increased production and accumulation of highly enriched uranium by Iran, the only non-nuclear weapon state to produce such nuclear material, is of serious concern, unquote. One would think that's a deal breaker for Trump. We shall see. South Korea has a new president. In snap presidential elections on June 2nd to replace the disgraced President Yoon Suk-yeol, Lee Jae-myung of the Liberal Democratic Party of Korea handily defeated Kim Mun-soo of the People Power Party. the former president's declaration of martial law last December and his attempt to have his rivals arrested triggered mass protests, Yun's impeachment, and his removal from office. Turnout in the election was 79%, the highest in 28 years. One observer noted that public reaction to the martial law regime was the central issue. Quote, "The Democratic Party of Korea effectively framed the race around the need to end the so-called insurrectionist forces and put guardrails on presidential powers concerning martial law. In contrast, the People Power Party's Kim failed to offer a clear message on how to address the aftermath of the martial law crisis." Unquote. This is the second time in 3 years that the Liberal Opposition Party has returned to power following the ruling party's self-destruction. Finally, here's an update on Greenland, which is still in Trump's sights. The Pentagon has announced a change in Greenland's location in the U.S. security structure. Greenland will now be under the Northern rather than European command. What this means for Trump's ambition to acquire Greenland is unclear, though symbolically it suggests separating Greenland from Denmark. Trump most recently reiterated his position, quote, "We need Greenland very badly. Greenland is a very small amount of people, which we'll take care of, and we'll cherish them, and all of that. But we need that for international security," unquote. The Pentagon's move also goes along with a Wall Street Journal report that U.S. intelligence is now increasing its spying on Greenland. "I have read the article in the Wall Street Journal," says Danish Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen, "and it worries me greatly because we do not spy on friends." The Wall Street Journal article said that U.S. intelligence was directed to learn more about Greenland's independence movement and attitudes toward American resource extraction. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. It has been noted by many observers that Ahmed al-Shara, Syria's president, has gotten a major makeover. At one time, he was a militant jihadist who showed no respect for ethnic or religious differences and felt free to order his fighters to massacre Alawis, Christians, and Yazidis. But now, with a trimmed beard and a new suit, he's been receiving fellow heads of state from the Middle East and elsewhere. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Charles Glass, a journalist who's written about the Middle East for many years, around the time President Trump announced the lifting of U.S. sanctions on Syria. Glass's latest book is Syria, Civil War to Holy War? He talked about al-Shara, the new Syrian government, and the overall situation in the country.
His wartime name was Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, Jolani being for the Golan Heights, because that's where his family came from. They were expelled by the Israelis in 1967 from their home in the Golan Heights. He grew up in Damascus, and during the Syrian uprising, well, actually before, he went to Iraq to fight against the Americans. He was imprisoned by the Americans for 6 years as a jihadist. When he was released, he joined another al-Qaeda group. He fought in Syria and in Iraq. He distanced himself after 2016 when the Syrian government was winning the war. He distanced himself from al-Qaeda, the al-Qaeda groups, and led his own group with Turkish backing called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. And it's Hayat Tahrir al-Sham that is now governing Syria, most of Syria, under his leadership. When he got to Damascus after Bashar al-Assad fled on December the 8th, he changed his clothes from battle fatigues. He trimmed his beard. He wears a suit and tie. But his metamorphosis was more than just the clothes and the beard. He changed his tune. He said where the jihadis during the war were killing Christians and members of the Alawite Muslim majority, who were the same religion as the president, they were killing them and telling them there was no place for them in Syria. When he came to power in Damascus, he began to cultivate these groups. He held meetings of bishops. He let the Christians celebrate Christmas and Easter as they always have. And he's trying to present himself as a more inclusive, incredible figure for all of Syria, not just for Sunni fundamentalists. His problem, of course, is that while that looks good to some of the minorities, and it looks good to Donald Trump, it may not look good to many of the jihadis who fought for 14 years to bring an Islamic State and not to bring a democracy.
And what about those other Islamist groups? Are they resentful now that Sharia's group has taken power?
Well, they control small portions of the country, particularly in the northwest between the government areas and the Kurdish areas. And they're not going along with it. They have put out posts saying that they regard him as having betrayed the holy cause of bringing an Islamic State to Syria. But to his credit, he is winning over more of the Syrian population by this talk of having a Syria for all Syrians, so that the Alawis and the Christians and the Ismailis and the Druze are not frightened into leaving the country. Although I have to say many of them are still frightened because they remember his group's record during the war. They were indeed Islamic fundamentalists. And many of the Alawis and Christians that I know, I left Syria in January, but many of them are still in touch with me saying they were desperate to get visas and to get out of the country because they fear for their lives.
So from your vantage point, do you think the new Syrian leadership is sincere in its statements about bringing the country together and not going after certain minority groups?
Well, the short answer is I don't know. There were several hundred Alawis killed in the Northwest in March by Islamic fundamentalists who nominally support Shara. He said that they were rogue elements and that he was going to try to control them. So far, no one's been arrested. Alawis who live in Damascus are afraid. Their neighborhood, which is called Meze 86, is surrounded by HTS checkpoints. And so everyone coming in and out is observed by them, and they feel that it's a little bit intimidating for them. Many of the children, Alawi children, receive social media posts on their phones saying that they're going to be killed, even by fellow students at the universities and the schools where they're studying. So there is an atmosphere of fear. It's hard to know how seriously Ahmed Shara takes that and how much he was either willing or able to control it.
And meanwhile, Trump is hinting at lifting the sanctions on Syria while the U.S. ally Israel has been bombing the country. And what do you make of that? What's going on there?
Well, Trump has said he is going to lift the sanctions on Syria, and that this will give the Syrian economy a chance to start up again. And they'll be able to deal with the international banking system. They'll be able to import and export goods. And you remember, Syria is a country that's completely devastated by war. 14 years of war has left, the infrastructure of the country absolutely wrecked. Not as bad as Gaza, but nearly as bad as Gaza. I mean, in Damascus, for example, they're lucky to have 2 hours a day of electricity. People are suffering, and they need to end the sanctions in order to rebuild the country, rebuild the infrastructure, and have a reason to stay in Syria and go on living in Syria. Israel seems to want to keep a very weak regime in Damascus that will never threaten Israel in any way, which is why they bombed weapons stores and places where the Syrian army had been, where the Israelis, or Benjamin Netanyahu, does not want the Shara government to have access to those weapons that the army left behind.
Can you see a conflict developing between Trump and the Israelis over Syria?
Conflict? No, certainly a difference of opinion. I mean, Israel can go on bombing it, and the U.S. will go on providing the weapons that enables Israel to bomb Gaza and parts of Lebanon and parts of Syria.
But I would imagine Shara would say, we don't like that, and you need to help us stop it, right?
He can say anything he likes, but he doesn't have many cards to play. I mean, just ending the sanctions will benefit him enormously. Rebuilding his army is something that the Israelis probably do not want to happen. And he's going to find it very difficult. And if he can't rebuild his army, he may not be able then to control those Islamists who want to terrify Christians and Alawis and Druze.
Is there any indication so far that Syria will have some kind of representative government?
Well, they put out a constitutional declaration which calls for that, but apparently there won't be elections for another 4 years. So it'll be like every other Arab state, really an unelected semi-dictatorship.
And what about the former members of the Syrian army under Assad? Where are they now?
Well, most of them have been dismissed. The ones who were Alawis, and there are large numbers of them, have gone back home to their areas in Mez 86 in Damascus and to the villages along the northwest coast of Syria in what's called Jebel Alawi, the Alawi Mountain. Many of them still have their arms, and they have attacked some of the HTS patrols in their areas.
And then what about the situation with the Kurds and the Turks attacking the Kurds? How does the government relate to that, the new government?
Shara's government has done an agreement with the Kurds of the Northwest, who are backed by the United States, to reintegrate them into the Syrian state, and the Kurds have accepted that. The PKK, which is the Turkish-Kurdish underground movement, which has been fighting a war in southeast Turkey for, I don't know, 20-odd years, maybe no more, they have disarmed. They are in the process of disarming because their leader, who's in prison in Turkey, Abdullah Öcalan, has ordered them to disarm and end the war against the Turkish state. So things are looking pretty good for Erdogan vis-a-vis the Kurds. He also wants to get Kurdish votes in Turkey in the upcoming election.
So you could foresee that there will be some sort of legitimate election in 4 years?
I can't foresee anything. I don't have a crystal ball. Many things can happen between now and then. Someone might assassinate Shara. There could be internal conflict within his movement. The Israelis could bomb his forces more dramatically than they have in the past. Any number of things could happen. And so also outside powers could arm some of the groups in Syria that are unhappy with the way things are. I mean, the outside powers, and I include now Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, United States and Turkey, have been meddling in Syria since 2011 when the conflict began. And some of them will go on meddling until they have an incentive to stop. Everything is precarious.
And what about the people who were involved in the local coordination committees back when the rebellion against Assad first started? Do you know where they're at now? Are they openly in opposition or are they supporting the new government?
Well, they were sidelined when the demonstrations gave way to violence in 2012. And I knew many of them. They were very idealistic young people, mainly university students, who thought the only way to get rid of Bashar al-Assad's dictatorship was by civil disobedience, demonstrations, and so on, that the regime wouldn't know how to cope with that. But those who wanted to take up arms and fight a holy war against him got the upper hand. So they were actually rendered irrelevant many years ago. Many of them were imprisoned by Assad. Many of them fled the country. Some of them are still out of the country. Some have come back and want to participate. We'll see if they're going to be able to participate.
And then did some join the Free Syrian Army?
Some did join the Free Syrian Army, yes. And some left the country.
And where is that army now?
No idea.
You just don't hear about them.
I haven't heard anything about them. Even when I was in Damascus, no one was talking about them. I think they were also, just as the peaceful demonstrators were overshadowed by the jihadis, so the Free Syrian Army was overshadowed by the jihadis, who were actually much better fighters than the Free Syrian Army. They were willing to risk their lives more effectively than the Free Syrian Army, who tried to behave as an army. And the jihadis behaved as jihadis and would do suicide bombings and take out Syrian army positions that way and then open up the way for their comrades to take over.
How much influence do you think Turkey will have in Syria at this point?
Turkey is the main benefactor and enabler of Shara's organization. The Turkish foreign minister, when he was head of military intelligence, he said this in an interview with French television, that he had been running Ahmad Shara, cooperating with him on intelligence matters for many years. So Turkey will have an overwhelming say in what happens in Syria.
And anything else you'd like to add to what you've said?
I think it's probably going to be good for the Syrian people that the sanctions are being lifted. We saw that when Assad was in power, and the sanctions were put in because of Assad, because the Western world wanted to get rid of Assad, that it actually didn't hurt his regime very much. They found other sources of income, mainly illegal drug dealing. But the people suffered a lot. And I think now the new regime, with its help from Turkey, can survive even under sanctions, but the country can't. And so it's probably a good thing for the people to have a chance to go back to school, go back to their jobs, rebuild the factories, get the farms going again, and make the country workable.
And will this new government does that mean that the relations between Syria and the rest of the Arab world will be improved, would you say?
It's already improved. Or, Shara has been to Riyadh. He met Trump in Riyadh. He's been to Jordan. He's invited the president of Lebanon to Damascus. He's already, reconstructed the bridges that were taken down when Bashar al-Assad was president.
And as far as the Saudis go, wasn't the enmity or hostility between the Saudis and Syria, didn't that have to do with Syria's alliance with Iran somewhat?
It was one of many factors. Also, Bashar al-Assad would not kowtow to the Saudis sufficiently to their liking. And now Iran is out of Syria, so that obstacle is gone.
And there's some sort of rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, would you say? Or the beginnings of one?
There has been. No, they established diplomatic relations a few years ago. And they are talking, and the Saudis have been encouraging these talks that the Americans are having with Iran over the nuclear issue, which the Israelis are very much against the Americans going behind their back and negotiating with Iran.
That's veteran writer and journalist Charles Glass speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg on KBOO News in Depth.
Listening to KBOO Portland